It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk to a music writer about the rise of psychedelic culture in the 1960s and its lasting impact on American culture today.
First, for hunters and outdoorsmen here in Wisconsin, one of the biggest concerns lately is the growing spread of chronic wasting disease in the state's deer population. While talk of that disease seems to have quieted down in recent years, recent data suggests it could be coming back in a big way.
In 2015, more than 9% of white-tailed deer tested in the state were positive for CWD. That's the highest it's been since the disease was discovered in Wisconsin in 2002. As a result, two state lawmakers called on Governor Walker and the Wisconsin DNR this week to take swift action to fight the disease before it gets worse.
With us now is one of those lawmakers, Chris Dano. He's a Democratic state representative from Trempealeau. He's also a member of the Assembly Committee on Natural Resources and Sporting Heritage. Representative Dano, thanks for joining us today. So along with Representative Nick Milroy, you sent a letter this week to Governor Walker calling on him to take action on CWD. Why did you feel you needed to draw the governor's attention to this?
Well, I think the recent data coming out of DNR's own studies show clearly that it's continued to be a problem. I think the scariest part about it is even though the actual number of deer tested went down, you're seeing an increase in the percentage and the prevalence and spread across the state. So I think it's clearly a problem that hasn't really been effectively dealt with, and it needs to be.
What specifically did you ask for in the letter?
Well, we really wanted them to take a hard look at what they're doing and see if there are things we can do to address both the actual spread of the disease across the state and the prevalence levels. I think what we'd really like the state to take a hard look at is to take a look at models that have gone on in other states, particularly Illinois, which has fairly high deer density and has some similar challenges to Wisconsin with agricultural zones, and look at what they've done to keep CWD from spreading and increasing. And quite frankly, it will mean probably having to take a more hands-on intensive management approach to dealing with it. And the pattern has been to go hands-off because it's been somewhat politically unpopular. And I think that we need to step up and do the right thing, maybe not what's politically popular.
Yeah, some people have criticized Wisconsin's approach as being passive in contrast to states like Illinois, you mentioned, and Michigan. What things aren't we doing that they're doing do you think we should be looking at? What kind of changes, what kind of lessons should we be learning, do you think, from Illinois and Michigan?
Well, I think to some extent, we've probably let some of it get away from us, and I think that's the biggest problem. I think what we really need to do is look at what we can do to keep it from spreading further and to keep the incidence down. And I think there's probably two things, is to look at some actual reductions in deer density in the really high density parts of the state, which are really the southern agricultural zones, and to also look at baiting and feeding. I think, in all honesty, I think we need to address baiting and feeding as the first step. I think that's probably the easiest thing that can be done statutorily and legally. And then look at doing some things to actually reduce deer density. That's a real challenge in the more southern part of the state where there's a lot more private land. But I think that's, if you look at what other states have done, that's been the focus, is to keep the densities down. It's a disease that's spread by deer-to-deer contact. And so with higher densities, the chance of it spreading becomes greater.
And the idea that baiting and feeding bring deer together to the same place, eating off of the same sources of food, maybe a higher point of transmission of the disease.
Oh, obviously, I think it's very clear that that's one of the major factors in it is, there's saliva dripping. I mean, they've shown it's transmitted through bodily fluids. And if you have a bunch of deer feeding off the same corn or bait pile, obviously there's going to be the sharing of bodily fluids, which is real troubling.
What do you worry about? What's your worst case if CWD isn't checked, if we don't dial up our efforts?
Well, I think it will go state. You'll see it become a statewide problem. You'll see the continued incidence of it, and potentially when you have a disease that gets bad enough, you could see a population crash. Now, I don't know whether we'd get to that point, but those are usually the kind of endpoints of any sort of disease outbreak. My biggest fear is that the other element that happens is that people become concerned, that there becomes such a prevalence of the disease across the state that people then become concerned about continuing to hunt and consume deer, and then you see a reduction in deer hunting in the state with all the various things that will happen, not only a reduction in revenue and economic impact, but in the long run, a reduction in deer hunting is bad for the overall health of the deer herd as well.
Talking to Chris Dano, Democratic State Representative from Trempealeau, he and a colleague wrote a letter to the governor and the DNR calling for more action on chronic wasting disease among the state's deer herd. And you mentioned that economic resource angle. That's something you brought up in the letter. How important do you see a deer hunting as part of Wisconsin's economy, first of all, and how threatened do you think that is by CWD?
Well, obviously, it's a billion-dollar-plus impact on the state's economy, really, on everything from, you know, clothing to hunting equipment to license sales. The revenue, deer hunting licenses revenue support DNR activities. We're continually, actually, even right now, struggling with declining hunter participation in a lot of outdoor, a lot of hunting sports, and I think that's just going to continue to be, if it gets to the point where, deer hunting becomes a real concern and the opportunities aren't there, or people are concerned about, the situation with the deer herd, I think it could have serious impacts. And like I said, deer hunting is probably the number one most important management tool we have available to the state wildlife managers as well. And if that no longer becomes a viable option, it, then sort of creates a situation where you've got a deer herd that population that starts to spiral out of control with the damage it will do to agriculture, the natural resources. And again, you're seeing even more spread of the disease and greater incidence of the disease among the deer population. And my fear is you're going to have this sort of large deer population that's sort of got a large reservoir of disease in it, then it creates just a generally unhealthy situation across a large part of the state.
As I understand it, you're a hunter yourself. How do you worry about the state's cultural heritage of hunting?
Well, it is, too. And just so you know, I also have a master's degree in wildlife biology. I worry about the cultural impacts it has on Wisconsin. Again, I think to a large degree, what's even more important and the economic impacts, deer hunting is the key management tool the DNR has to actually manage the deer herd. And if people become concerned and are unwilling to hunt deer, or you see start to see real rapid declines in the number of people out hunting deer, you're going to, again, it'll sort of become a situation where we have an exploding deer herd again, and potentially exploding deer herd, which would increase the prevalence of the disease even more, and it just sort of, again, it starts to become a self-reinforcing cycle that could become very difficult to get a handle on.
At this point, do you think CWD is something that could be eradicated in Wisconsin, or is this something we're just trying to contain at this point?
I think from everything I know about the way the disease is spread, we are stuck with CWD. I think we had a chance to eradicate it. Had we acted more quickly, it was possible. We will have to probably live with it. And that's the thing. We're going to have to understand, live with it, and come up with a way to manage it for the long term, to keep the incidence of the disease as low as possible, and to try and keep it from spreading to other parts of the state as long as possible.
And for hunters in CWD-affected areas, do you think there's enough access to testing to make sure that deer can be tested before they're consumed, make sure they're not carrying CWD?
My understanding there generally is. I think what needs to happen, though, is the DNR was cutting back on its testing regime, and it's clear from these results they probably need to expand it again. I mean, when you saw them, with the lowest, they had a relatively low, one of the lowest numbers of deer they've ever tested for CWD, and to see the prevalence and incidence increase, it seems to me obvious they actually need to ramp up the testing again and start to get a better handle on what's really going on, to see if this was just a statistical aberration or if the trends that are continuing really are happening, and to make sure and to really get a good handle on what's actually going on out there.
Now, we might not think of this as a partisan issue, but lots of things have become partisan issues these days. This letter is from you and a Democratic colleague to a Republican governor. With all that in mind, are you trying to bring Republicans, your colleagues in the legislature, in on this? Is there room for cooperation?
I think so. I think, an issue like this really isn't partisan. I think when issues become partisan, it becomes more difficult to deal with them, unfortunately. I don't want this to be a partisan issue. If it becomes partisan, it makes it more difficult to deal with. I've been trying to have some discussions with my colleagues on the other side of the aisle on this. Nick and I are pretty good friends. We know each other. We've both got natural resources backgrounds. So we felt after seeing what was going on, we needed to move something out quickly. But we do want to reach out to our colleagues on the other side of the aisle and make sure that they have as much of a – it doesn't matter whether you're Democrat or Republican on an issue like this. We have an investment and a long-term concern – over the health of Wisconsin's deer herd. I think what would help, though, is for both sides to agree we may have to step up and do some things that may be seen as somewhat unpopular. And if Democrats and Republicans are willing to hold hands and sort of dive into those waters, it will be easier to do. And I think that's my big main throat, is to say some of the things that may need to be done to control the spread of CWD may be unpopular with elements of the public, including those people like to feed and bait deer, and maybe people that are unhappy with the people that do like seeing higher deer numbers and density because it provides more hunting opportunity. But those are things that if we can do as Democrats and Republicans together, maybe we can convince people that they need to be done.
Representative Dano, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Chris Dano, Democratic State Representative from Trempealeau. He joined us to talk about a letter he wrote along with Representative Nick Milroy calling on Governor Walker and the DNR to take action on fighting chronic wasting disease here in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a look at Catholics in the United States and their views on marriage and family after Pope Francis released the document, The Joy of Love, last week.
First, the roots of psychedelic culture in the United States are deep and wide-reaching and gave us a lot of music. We just heard a little taste of it there. A new book traces the history of an American subculture that exploded into the national consciousness in the 1960s and still influences our culture today.
Our next guest traces the influence of psychedelics on everything from the Grateful Dead and other bands to the rise of the modern internet. Joining us now is Jesse Jarno, author of Heads, a biography of psychedelic America. Jesse, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, is it fair to say that we're in a psychedelic renaissance, or is this a culture that's never really gone away?
I'd argue that it's never really gone away. There's been this amazing resurgence in research over the past few years, including a bunch of groundbreaking studies that were literally just released over the past two or three days. But really what I guess my argument is that over the last 50 years, psychedelics have played an important influence in American culture kind of at every point through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and right on into the 21st century.
This has been a topic that's fascinated researchers and scholars for at least the last decade or so. What made you want to take a new look at this?
Well, I guess it was that I started looking at the influence of the Grateful Dead. There was sort of a resurgence of interest in them about 10 years back, and I sort of started looking at the bigger picture and the bigger picture of that and just sort of the long arc of psychedelic culture in the United States, and realized that there was a story there that I, you know, knew bits and pieces of, and really wanted to know the bigger chunks of, in terms of its influence on the computer industry, in terms of its influence on American spirituality, in terms of all of these things, and how the Grateful Dead were kind of a thread through all of that over 30 years, and still beyond the death of Jerry Garcia in 1995.
And you mentioned the stories, and there are a lot of stories when you start looking at psychedelic culture. And you begin with one that kind of gets at when psychedelics burst into the mainstream at a place called the Dollar Sign. Can you tell us a little bit about that particular story?
Oh, yeah, sure. So the Dollar Sign was this cafe in New York's East Village in the late 50s. And they sold peyote over the counter, which is the cactus that grows in the Southwest and in Texas and down into Mexico, and which has been used for centuries as, you know, a source of spiritual experiences for different tribes, most lately the Native American Church. And in the 1950s, you know, those crazy beatniks in the East Village discovered that they could import peyote totally legally. They could just order it from these mail order companies in Texas. And this enterprising fellow named Baron Bruklos ordered it and repackaged it for sale in little capsules and sold it over the counter at the Dollar Sign Cafe, which was his coffee house. And that was one of the ways that psychedelics began to spread into the network. We're kind of through these little places that turned out to be groundbreaking, just these very casual arrangements of, oh, yeah, sure, I'm going to order some peyote from Texas. And it had this incredible rippling influence, not from the Dollar Sign, but another East Villager who ordered peyote from Texas was Allen Ginsberg. And that, you know, that became a huge influence on Howl, his massively important poem that was published during that decade.
Right. And Allen Ginsberg is just one example. There are tons of examples. But can you tell us about some of the most prominent ones where the psychedelic culture overlapped with and influenced artistic culture?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of my favorite stories in this is Keith Haring, the great pop artist. And I knew that he had been influenced by psychedelics and by the Grateful Dead. There's sort of a, I guess, infamous among deadheads, at least, picture of his one of his old journals with a big Grateful Dead bumper sticker on it. And I started digging into the research and discovered that he was a massive deadhead and a massive psychedelic fan. And I interviewed his old roommate and studio mate, and she told me about this T-shirt that they made, which was a Grateful Dead bootleg shirt that Keith Haring designed, and it was his first ever publicly sold artwork. It was a pirated Grateful Dead logo of the Steal Your Face, which is a skull with a lightning bolt in it, and then he drew what later became these very, you know, recognizable Keith Haring psychedelic squigglies, and made these shirts and sold them, and it was a really sort of pivotal point in his artistic career, and he kind of passed through the dead world and the psychedelic world en route to becoming this pop artist, you know, this world famous pop artist, but sort of pulling in these influences from the counterculture and beyond. He's certainly one of them.
We're talking with journalist Jesse Jarno right now. He has written a new book called Heads, a biography of psychedelic America. And Jesse, was there something about the politics and the zeitgeist of the 60s that lent themselves well to people being open to this sort of psychedelic culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think the baby boom was certainly a huge part of that, and kind of this sort of post-war prosperity where things were seemed to be stable in the United States for a while, at least until the beginning of the Vietnam War. And it led to the sort of generation of very open-minded people. And it connects up to the political situation in all kinds of ways because, you know, the civil rights movement and the escalating Vietnam War, there was a lot of density and a lot of anger, and sort of head politics became a way to sort of opt out of that and sort of find a third path that wasn't sort of just a simple cut and dry Republican versus Democrat or anything like that. It was sort of the system versus the universe. And I think psychedelics really fed into that sort of apolitical mindset in a really energetic, active way and still do.
And the Grateful Dead were a part of that, and the culture didn't begin or end with them, but why did they become such a hub for this sort of psychedelic culture that you're describing?
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is in the Dead's origins, which is their first patron and their first sound man was a guy named Owsley Stanley, who was the first huge underground LSD chemist in the United States. And he used his LSD profits to fund the Dead, among other artistic endeavors. And they played Ken Kesey's acid tests and were really intimately involved with the early Bay Area psychedelic culture, so much so that LSD dealers and people who like taking psychedelic drugs just sort of naturally gravitated to that world. And they found this momentum to continue through the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, where so many other elements of that culture kind of fell away. And they became sort of a critical mass. They became the mainstream of psychedelic America in a way that carried that torch and that became a very literal common ground for all kinds of different factions of, you know, environmentalists and radical feminists and, you know, people who are into technology. All could kind of come together under this umbrella of, you know, the big freaky Grateful Dead. And psychedelics was a bonding point there.
You mentioned mainstream culture. I mean, did psychedelics ever become mainstream? I did see a movie last year where there were a bunch of well-heeled Brooklynites who got together in a house to take ayahuasca. But, I mean, is psychedelic culture mainstream today, or was it ever?
I would argue that it was absolutely mainstream in the 60s and 70s and became a pretty important point in, you know, visual design and music and, you know, with bands like The Dead and Jimi Hendrix and things like that. The sort of the modern iteration of mainstream psychedelia is not quite that in your face, you know, 60s style stuff. It's moving in the form of legitimate research and sort of above ground work at places like NYU and Johns Hopkins. And the study I referenced earlier from the Beckley Institute in the United Kingdom, and that's sort of the direction it's moving in, kind of away from these, you know, crazy underground parties into really looking at the things that make psychedelics work and make them so amazing. And a lot of these studies are kind of getting into the territory where they're giving the first scientific confirmation of things that, you know, people taking who've been taking psychedelics in this country for 50 years have known, sort of the potential of the combination of psychedelics and music and therapy was a paper that was just released yesterday, and things like that.
So what do you think is the next horizon for psychedelics and psychedelic culture in America, both in arts and also in medical applications?
Right. I mean, I think that's sort of where I guess that last study, I think, is going, where people are now, you know, studies on LSD and psychedelics have been suspended really for the last half century because of the stigma of the drugs and kind of everything that happened. And I think what's really going to happen now is that these studies are going to sort of start confirming and getting into what people have been sort of saying and informally for decades. You know, another recent study was a pilot study to study synesthesia, the sort of the blends of colors and sounds and smells that a lot of people traditionally report on psychedelic drugs. And because there really hasn't been any research for the last half century, nobody's been ever been able to design a study to even attempt to quantify this stuff. And it's really just the building blocks at this point. And beyond that, it's pretty endless. I'm really excited to see what comes next.
Jesse, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jesse Jarno, author of the new book, Heads, A Biography of Psychedelic America.
Pope Francis issued Amoris Laetitia, or The Joy of Love, last week, a 256-page document that doesn't lay out new doctrine, but did encourage more openness to people living in what the Church considers non-traditional relationships.
The document called on priests to be more open to Catholics who are divorced or who are part of same-sex couples and unmarried couples that live together. It's received mixed responses from Catholic communities, some relieved that it didn't change church rules, others disappointed that it didn't go far enough.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what the Pope said? Do your personal views usually line up with the official views of your faith, whichever faith it is, or are there areas of disagreement? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've posted some research from the Pew Research Center about American Catholics. Again, you can call in 800-642-1234. Joining us now to talk about how American Catholics view family structures and connections that the Church considers non-traditional, we have Jessica Martinez with us. She's a senior researcher at Pew Research Center who contributes to the Center's reporting on religion in the U.S. Jessica, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a core idea of your research seems to be that the ideas of the official church, in this case the Catholic Church, and its practitioners here in the United States don't always match up one-to-one. What kind of disagreements or disjunctions do you find?
Yeah, well, we did a survey just last year in advance of Pope Francis coming to the U.S. for the World Meeting of Families that largely focused on Catholics and what they think about family and various family arrangements and relationships. And we find that U.S. Catholics are largely accepting of this variety of so-called non-traditional family arrangements, and they would really like for the church to be more accepting as well. So roughly 6 in 10 Catholics, for example, think that the church should allow Catholics who are living with a romantic partner without being married to participate in communion. And a similar share think the church should allow those who have been remarried after a divorce without having gotten an annulment to receive communion. And they're largely accepting also of people living together without being married, even of children being raised in these kinds of environments. So they're very accepting of these kinds of family arrangements, and they'd like for the church to become more accepting as well.
Well, that brings us to this document from Pope Francis. As I looked through parts of it, it's a long document, and as other people have read it, it's not saying the church is changing its policies on cohabitation or birth control or same-sex marriage, but it says from country to country, the local Catholic officials can have different approaches on how open they are, and it seems like they're suggesting that the church hierarchy can be more open to people outside of that traditional one man, one woman, having kids kind of marriage. Do you see the church in some ways, at least in tone, meeting public opinion halfway?
Well, it certainly seems like the tone of this document is in line with what Catholics have told us in surveys about what they would like to see the church doing. Of course, like you said, it's not making any doctrinal changes, and so it's not going as far as what some Catholics would like to see. But at the same time that we ask people whether they would like to see these kinds of changes, we also ask whether they think they're likely to occur in the next few decades. And Catholics were less likely to think that these sorts of changes will actually take place than to say they think they ought to take place.
I want to get a picture of religion here in Wisconsin and Catholicism in particular. What do you know from your research there at Pew?
Yeah, well, we know from our religious landscape study, which was a large-scale survey of more than 35,000 people in the U.S. that we conducted in 2014, so it allows us to look at state-by-state figures. In Wisconsin, about 7 in 10 Wisconsin adults identify with a Christian faith, and this includes just over 4 in 10 who identify with a Protestant faith, and about a quarter who consider themselves Catholic. Another quarter or so who are religiously unaffiliated, so the group that we sometimes refer to as religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, and that they say they have no particular religion or that they're atheist or agnostic. And then smaller shares, roughly 4% or so in Wisconsin, who identify with non-Christian faiths like Judaism or Islam or Buddhism.
And your data, at least nationally, tries to get a sense of the influence of Catholicism. So how many people, when we look at not just practicing Catholics, but lapsed Catholics, people who consider themselves, I think the phrase was cultural Catholics, how many people have interacted with Catholicism in a key way in their lives at some point?
Yeah, so in that survey that I mentioned that we did last year in May and June of 2015, we asked in the same way we always do about religious affiliation and found, roughly 1 in 5 people, adults in the U.S., identify as Catholic. But we also wanted to know about broader connections to Catholicism. So we also asked for those who did not identify Catholicism as their religious identity, if they consider themselves to be Catholic or partially Catholic in any way or not. And we also ask questions about having been raised Catholic and other kinds of connections, being married to a Catholic or having Catholic parents. And we find, all in all, roughly 45% of people have some kind of close connection to Catholicism in this way. That includes about 1 in 10 U.S. adults who we call cultural Catholics in our analysis. And that's people who said their religion was either, Protestantism, or maybe they don't have a particular religion. But when we ask the follow-up of whether they consider themselves to be Catholic or partially Catholic in any way, they said, yes, indeed, they do. Many of those folks were raised Catholic. And then there's another 1 in 10 or so people who were raised Catholic but no longer identify as such when we ask the question about religious identity, and also say no when we ask if they still consider themselves to be Catholic or partially Catholic in any way. And that's the group that we called ex-Catholics in our analysis.
Talking to Jessica Martinez with the Pew Research Center, looking at religion in the United States, Catholicism in particular, and views of family structure, traditional family structure as described by the Catholic Church, a new document from Pope Francis, not changing anything in Catholic doctrine related to, say, divorced people, to same-sex marriage, to people living together outside the bonds of marriage, but suggesting that church officials have a more open stance toward them, make sure they don't exclude them from the faith. We'll go down to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Adam with us on the line in Milwaukee. Adam, hi.
Hi, I am a 25-year-old gay male living in Wisconsin, and I was raised Catholic and confirmed Catholic, and I've always considered faith to be a very important part of who I am, and I have been so pleased with this Pope. Everything that he's done, from talking about, who he believes can get into heaven, and now with this new idea of family structure, I don't think anyone in the LGBT community is expecting them to change what the Bible says and change that. But to have someone be truly embodying what it means to be Christian and spreading that love, I'm often asked, how can you be gay and Catholic? When Catholics say that being gay is so wrong. And, it's great to have a Pope who says it doesn't matter, what happens outside, as long as you, believe and are love and are a good person. And so I think he's done great things, and I'm hoping that he will bring more young people and more LGBT people, you know, some of the people who need faith the most, back into the Catholic Church.
Adam, I want to ask, you've mentioned the Pope and you've mentioned doctrine. How about the Catholic community you interact with in Milwaukee? Do you feel part of that community?
You know, and yeah, absolutely. I think that there's obviously some people who don't know that I'm gay, but the majority of people who know that I'm gay in the church have been very, very accepting and very tolerant. It's obviously not something that we like discuss at church, but you know, I've gone to church with my partner, and they are very accepting and know that we are Christians and we are good people, and we, you know, the fact that I happen to be in a relationship with a man, and you know, doesn't define me who I am and doesn't define me in the eyes of God, and they see that. So it's good to see that a Pope, you know, is starting to preach the message of love and acceptance, you know, rather than hate and ostracizing a group of people.
Adam, thanks for sharing your experience. Jessica, one thing he mentioned there, he said, something like he doesn't expect the church ultimately to change its official position on same-sex marriage. I know you've done work on surveying Catholics on whether they think the church will change its positions on family matters. What kind of things did you find out?
Yeah, well, we find that close to half of Catholics think that the church should recognize the marriages of gay and lesbian couples. Overall, Catholics are somewhat divided on whether the church should or should not. They're less likely to think that it will happen. Just over a third think that in the next few decades, perhaps the church will come around and recognize same-sex marriages. Outside of the church context, Catholics have become increasingly likely to say they're in favor of same-sex marriage being legal more generally, and they really look a lot like the general public overall on this matter, where the general public has moved pretty quickly in the last decade or so towards saying they think that same-sex marriage should be legal. More Catholics saying it should be a legal option than saying the church should actually recognize it, but still a fairly large group of people saying that they think the church should recognize same-sex marriages as well.
Thanks, Adam. We'll go now to Esther in Grays Lake. Esther, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, Esther?
Maybe I don't really understand what the Pope has said, but I just don't necessarily agree with it, just at first blush. Being a divorced Catholic, I just feel like my ex-husband, who was the one that decided in our relationship that he no longer wanted to be married, so I really didn't have a say in my destiny. He left and now is living with a divorced Catholic woman, and I feel, in my opinion, that they are living in sin. The marriage is one of the sacraments of the church, and I just feel like giving them a pass to say, it's okay, is wrong, and I find it insulting to people like myself.
Esther, thanks a lot for the call. And Jessica, there are people who are in line with what the Pope's saying or want more, and there are definitely Catholics in your research who think this kind of thing might go too far. Is that right?
Yes, certainly. A third of Catholics do not think that the church should allow cohabiting Catholics to receive communion, and a similar share say they don't think that the church should allow those who have remarried without an annulment to receive communion either. So it's certainly not a unanimous opinion among Catholics that the church should make these kinds of changes.
We're talking to Jessica Martinez, senior researcher at the Pew Research Center, looking at American Catholics' attitudes toward non-traditional family structures.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a Catholic who's chosen a more traditional family structure, or maybe you've adopted a family lifestyle that is contrary to some of the church's teachings? Should the church be more welcoming to people who've been divorced or to same-sex couples? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Again, that's 800-642-1234. We're continuing our conversation with Jessica Martinez, senior researcher at Pew Research Center. The Pope released The Joy of Love last week, a document that many have noted has a tone that seems more open to Catholics living in non-traditional families. We're talking about American Catholics' attitudes toward families, especially things like divorce, LGBT life, and contraception, and where they might differ from church doctrine.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does religion, how does your faith play into how you've made decisions about your family, and does your practice line up with your church, your religious organization's teachings? Maybe you're a religious leader who's had to advise members of your congregation on matters of family, divorce, and relationships. Call in now. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers now with Ryan in River Falls. Ryan, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. I was raised by a Catholic family. I'm you know, a confirmed Catholic, I guess, technically speaking, but I don't practice any of that anymore. I'm not religious, but to me, it just seems like when the church comes out with these statements and people seem to be very like happy and, you know, oh, they're, you know, they're being, you know, more understanding and all of this kind of thing. To me, it seems very clear that the church, when they come out with statements like this, is just, to me, it seems like an attempt to avoid criticism and like negate some of the things that they have been harshly criticized for in the past, rather than just, you know, doing it in like a genuinely, you know, nice way. Because if you really look at the history of the Christian faith, the Catholic faith, it's been pretty clear that for, you know, centuries, this whole thing has been, you know, same-sex marriage, non-traditional family situations, it's all been looked down upon heavily. And to me, it just seems very clear that the church is just trying to avoid some of the criticism that they have received for that.
All right, Ryan, thanks a lot for the call. And Jessica, I know based on your research, you probably can't explore the motives behind what the church is doing. But if it is, in fact, speaking to public opinion, that might be tricky because public opinion is divided among Catholics, isn't it?
That's certainly the case. You know, on some of these topics, it's a majority of Catholics who'd like to see some change, but on others, like you know, the issue of same-sex marriage that we talked about briefly, Catholics are relatively divided over whether they think the church should make any changes to be more welcoming or not.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call, Ryan. And you were touching on this a little earlier. I wanted to dig into some more of the data you have. You surveyed Catholics on different types of family setup and whether they viewed them as good as any other family, acceptable but not as good, or unacceptable. A man and a woman with kids, pretty much everybody you surveyed was all for that. What did you find with other types of families?
Right. So it certainly seems to be the case that, you know, a vast majority of Catholics think this so-called traditional arrangement of a mother and father raising children is sort of an ideal situation. But we also find majorities of Catholics saying it's at least acceptable to some degree for children to be raised by unmarried parents who are living together, so cohabiting, or to be raised by a gay or lesbian couple, to be raised by single parents or divorced parents. And then just sort of taking children out of the equation, large majorities of Catholics think it's acceptable and as good as any other way of life for a husband and wife to choose not to have children at all, or for a man and a woman to cohabit outside of marriage. And nearly half say it's acceptable and as good as any other way of life for a same-sex couple to cohabit. So lots of acceptance sort of across the board on these various kinds of arrangements that we asked about.
Talking to Jessica Martinez from the Pew Research Center, looking at a new document from the Pope on family structure. No major changes, no changes in doctrine, but an invitation to be more open to what the church considers non-traditional family arrangements. I will go back to our callers with Simon now in Madison. Simon, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I'm Catholic. I'm a father of three. I'm married. And, you know, I frankly don't really care. People's beliefs are what they are, and they should be able to be who they want to be with. It's much more important to you know, accept and try to help people than to try to judge other people about how they choose to live their life. You know, on the issue of parenting, I'd much rather have two same-sex really good parents than two individuals who don't really care for each other and don't provide a good home for the child. Just because they're married and Catholic doesn't mean they're good parents.
All right, Simon, thanks a lot for that call. And Jessica, we've heard from people who are disagreeing with their church to a greater or lesser extent. Maybe this is getting too much into the realm of psychology for the research you've done, but in your polling, at least, do you find that that creates a tension among people that they're Catholics, they're in the church all the way, but there are these substantial differences?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because what we see is that, you know, there are a lot of folks in the U.S. who identify as Catholic, who have a very positive view of their church, of their Pope. You know, 7 in 10 Catholics tell us they can't imagine ever leaving the church, no matter what. But they don't have a problem necessarily disagreeing with some of these teachings of the church and expressing the fact that they disagree. And so while you might sort of expect that there'd be some kind of tension here, really we find it common that people might disagree with certain aspects of doctrine while still very much holding on to the Catholic identity and expressing, you know, positive views about their church overall.
Thanks a lot for the call. One point I wanted to get into, Jessica, I know part of your research is on Latinos and religion in America. Any striking differences between Latinos in America and the rest of the population on these issues?
Well, just kind of thinking broadly about the trends that we've been seeing in religion in the United States, we find that the share who identify with no particular religion has been increasing in the United States more broadly, and we see this among Latinos as well. But nonetheless, Catholicism is still sort of the predominant faith among Latinos, and Latinos, in fact, make up about a third of all Catholics in the United States. So a big portion of Catholics in the United States are Latino, and they tend to agree somewhat more with the church on these issues than white non-Hispanic Catholics. So tend to be somewhat more in line with church teachings on some of these various issues.
We'll leave it there for now. Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Jessica Martinez. She's a senior researcher at Pew Research Center. She's been talking to us about American Catholics' views on family life and non-traditional relationships, following up on Pope Francis's recent document looking at family relationships and how the Catholic Church views them. No changes in doctrine, but an invitation to local church officials to maybe be more open to unmarried couples, divorced people, and same-sex couples. You can continue sharing your thoughts, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page. Yesterday on Central Time, Veronica and I tried out Sweden's new Dial-a-Swede program, where you call this number and you get connected with a random Swede, and then you talk. We met Victor from Stockholm. It turns out he's a Packers fan who plays American football, if you can believe it.
And, of course, one high point of the conversation, Rob, you tried to open things up with some phrases that you'd taken the trouble to learn in Swedish, some stuff you picked up on the internet, and here's what happened.
Good dog. Jag heter Rob, talar du engelska?
Now, what I believed I was saying there was, hello, my name is Rob, do you speak English? What Victor heard was, I think, incomprehensible gibbering, possibly, he said, in Norwegian. So it turns out I speak Swedish badly and with a Norwegian accent for some reason.
Well, I always assumed that Norwegian was your native tongue and you keep bringing these Lefse ideas to our editorial meetings. So I understand where Victor was coming from.
I got no Norwegian in me at all. So I don't know where that comes from. And I've been told when I try to speak Spanish, which I don't, and I'm bad at it, that I for some reason have an Italian accent.
We can't blame Victor. I mean, he did say, he seemed very confused, and then he said, sorry, I don't speak Norwegian.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave with a little foreign language learning skills from ABBA. This is Central Time.